afternoon, Justice Ridgely. Good afternoon, Justice Steele. Good afternoon, Justice Berger. I am Carol Dunn, and I'm here in support of the case of Douglas versus State. This is a case involving several convictions that were obtained at trial: robbery, possession of a firearm during commission of a felony, aggravated menacing, the attached possession of a firearm during commission of a felony, wearing a disguise in the felony, and conspiracy second. During the course of the trial, additional charges, two additional charges of kidnapping, along with their associated possession of a firearm during commission of a felony, were not sent forth to the jury. That is also part of this appeal today. In our opening brief, we argued basically two issues. Argument one involved the use of the prosecutor's notes during a jury trial to refresh the recollection of a state witness in regard to a statement made purportedly at a pretrial meeting with that state witness, with the prosecutor, and with one of the two victims at trial who also testified at trial. We argued on that issue that in accord with the Hughes case in Delaware, that the prosecutor should either avoid using trial notes at trial, his or her own personal notes at trial, or that prosecutor must withdraw from the trial. In this case, that didn't happen. The trial judge in this case indicated at a bench conference that literally almost anything could be used to refresh a witness's recollection, and allowed that recollection to occur at trial, thereby letting in testimony, basically a purported statement made by a victim witness at trial during that meeting, that he feared for his life, that he feared that that day of the robbery would be his last day on earth. As we pointed out in the brief, this is an element of the aggressive menacing statute that needs that the state needs to prove by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. When that victim witness testified at trial, all he said about his state of mind and his feeling at the time of the robbery was that he wasn't concerned about his health. He was more concerned about the female store clerk's health or safety. When asked two additional times in direct testimony by the state at trial, this victim, Mr. Hill, indicated no, he wasn't concerned about his health. He was more concerned about the condition of the store clerk at the time. The Hughes case, we think, should hold in this case, in as much as it appears to be the only case in Delaware that I could find relating to the issue.
Does that mean, can it be inferred when you look at that in the light most favorable to the state, since there was a conviction, that he had some concern, but he was really more concerned about the other people in the store?
Well, he did, that victim witness did testify at trial that he had some concern.
Isn't that enough?
Well, when one reads the aggravated menacing statute, what is required there as an element is that one has to be placed in fear of imminent physical injury. That victim witness also testified at trial that upon, towards the end of the robbery that occurred that evening, upon being led into a cooler inside that store, he did not remember seeing a weapon or a gun at that time in the perpetrator's hands. We think the threshold is higher than just having some concern in order to be convicted of the felony of aggravated menacing. And we think in this case that what may have pushed that issue over the edge for the jury might have been that very statement that came into testimony, as substantive testimony, that this witness reportedly said on a different occasion, months after the incident occurred, that he feared that this might be his last day on earth. That was the statement that was contained in the prosecutor's notes. Now, the way that occurred at trial the manner that occurred at trial is that while the victim witness was on the stand during direct testimony, the prosecutor questioned him on his state of mind, never asking directly, did you ever make a statement that you feared that that would be your last day on earth? But in response to the questions, the responses all, for the most part, were he didn't have a concern about his own health, that he was more concerned about the store clerk. 3507, comes into play here because the state laid the foundation for a 3507 statement, that being that statement about fearing it was his last day on earth. While the victim witness was on the stand, the witness did indicate that he attended a meeting, that they did discuss the robbery during that meeting. Also present at that meeting with the prosecutor and that victim witness was the social worker who is in the employ of the state in the prosecutor's office. She was called as a witness, and through that witness and through the mechanism of Section 3507, that statement came into trial. How the notes are involved is that while the social worker was testifying, the prosecutor's notes to that witness, her notes of that meeting. That statement was never contained in the notes of the social worker who attended that meeting, and she, on cross-exam, indicated that. Our problem with this is that it was impossible to do full cross-examination about the statement in those notes, inasmuch as the prosecutor was at trial prosecuting the case, could not be called as a witness, and the prosecutor, in order to be able to cross-examine her, she would have had to withdraw as a prosecutor from that trial.
It's so interesting that you say he could not be called as a witness.
The prosecutor?
Yeah.
Yes.
Why not?
Well, it would be an ethical violation to for any attorney who is involved in a trial to be called as a witness in that trial.
Well, I understand it would be disruptive, but it's not as if it's impossible, since he is a fact witness, to call him as a fact witness, is it?
I believe it is under our ethics rules. I believe it is, but a prosecutor...
It may be unethical for him to both prosecute and be a witness in a trial, from his perspective, but what is it that prevents you from indicating that you wish him to testify because he's possessed of facts that are important to your case?
I did not indicate that at trial because the consensus in discussing this with the trial judge was that the prosecutor couldn't be called as a witness in her case that she was prosecuting. So I did not make that request.
The trial judge made a ruling that you could not call her to
didn't make a specific ruling. No, Your Honor, did not make a specific ruling. I didn't ask because it was my belief that the consensus of the three of us, the prosecutor, myself, and the trial judge, was that this prosecutor could not be called as a witness in her own in the trial that she was prosecuting. So I did not make that request at trial. The cases that are cited in the briefs, as well as the state's briefs, Hughes v. State, Riccardi is also a case, and the Stallworth case. Especially the Riccardi and the Stallworth cases indicate that the proper analysis for refreshing one's recollection under the rule, Delaware Rule of Evidence 612, is that the witness currently had no memory no present memory or recollection of the event trying to be recalled.
Well, I'm looking at 895 of your appendix, and it has these questions. Having reviewed to Ms. Bronstein, having reviewed those notes, does it refresh your recollection? Yes. Did Mr. Hill articulate what was going through his mind that day? Yes. He did indicate that he thought this might be his last day. What's the matter with that? Isn't that exactly the proper procedure to refresh recollection?
That is. I'm not saying that the procedure was not followed. The witness indicated on the stand prior to that time she had no recollection or she stated on the stand what her recollection was, and it did not include that phrase that was just read. After the notes were given to this witness, and after she refreshed her recollection, is when that statement came out. And procedurally, it did ignite. You know, the what she said was a prior memory or recollection. So procedurally, but the analysis, what we're arguing is that the analysis that should have been applied by the trial judge prior to even allowing those notes to come in and be used in that manner was not followed. In accordance with the Riccardi case and with the Stallworth case, that analysis would include such questions as question at issue totally dependent on the prosecutor's notes? And in this case, they certainly were. The victim witness never testified to that on the stand. The social worker didn't mention that prior to being able to read it from the prosecutor's notes. We believe that the nature of the writing used to refresh recollection should have been analyzed a little bit more thoroughly in this case.
Is it correct that the notes were not read into the record?
That's correct. That's correct. That the
so notes the were only read. Evidence that the jury heard was refresh recollection testimony from a witness who had reviewed the notes.
That's correct. That's correct. However, the analysis that preceded that should have included, we are arguing, such questions as was that witness's recollection after it was refreshed totally dependent upon what was in those notes, and it was. We believe that the nature of the instrument itself, the fact that they were prosecutor's notes being shown to a state witness, is there any kind of suggestion of subterfuge there or coaching a witness or suggesting
Did you say that the social worker was an employee of the Attorney General's office?
That's correct.
So in theory, she worked for the same prosecutor whose notes she was asked to review and determine whether they accurately reflected what occurred
That's
in
right.
the meeting.
That's correct. And they both were at the same meeting. That social worker brought her own notes and referred to those, which did not include that statement. In fact, it included a statement that he was more concerned about the store clerk. We feel that the nature of the instrument itself should have been looked at a little bit more carefully prior to making that decision. The fact that they were prosecutor's notes, the fact that they were being used in reality to change the testimony, to almost impeach the testimony of that victim witness, should have been given greater consideration. We feel that when there is an issue of prosecutor's notes being used at a trial, in any matter, in this case it was refreshing recollection, that there has to be consideration given to the nature of that instrument being used and whether or not there is any possibility of coaching involved here, unfairness to the other side. This is an issue that just popped up at trial. I did not see the notes prior to trial. A copy was given to me at trial. And I've included that in my answering brief to the state's cross.
Now, to make sure I understand the significance of all of this, it goes to the element of menacing that refers to fear of imminent injury.
That's correct.
And it's your position that in the absence of this refreshed recollection from someone else's notes who employed her, that the only evidence was Mr. Hill's comments, I wasn't concerned about my health, I'm more concerned about Amy's. Were you at all worried about what would happen to you? Answer, not necessarily. And then, I was worried about Amy's safety. Were you worried about yourself? No, not especially. So the point is, I take it that in the absence of this refreshed recollection, that was the evidence before the jury, and it was insufficient to either get the issue to the jury or for the jury to convict on menacing.
That's correct.
And it's limited to menacing.
It's limited to menacing and the associated charge. If a conviction is not obtained on the aggravated menacing count in this case, the associated and related possession of a firearm during commission of a felony would also be out. So it really basically affected two counts.
Okay, you have about a minute left. Do you want to reserve your time or do you want to use it?
Your Honor, I just wanted to say that this argument concerning the prosecutor's notes is related to the second argument that I made on insufficiency of evidence for the aggravated menacing charge. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
May
it please the court, my name is Kim Avazian and I represent the state in this matter. This is not like the Hughes case. Now, based on the reference in the Hughes decision to the prosecutor's use of his or her own notes in that case, it appears as though there was no other individual who was a witness to that interview with the defense witnesses there. Here we have a social worker who worked for the Department of Justice. This information came out during the direct examination. Her notes were referred to refresh her recollection. She could not remember exactly any details of their interview with Mr. Hill, who was the victim in this case, one of the victims in this case. And the prosecutor asked then if she could use her own personal notes of the interview to refresh the recollection of the witness, Mrs. Bronstein, who was the social worker.
Why was that done in front of the jury?
Why was it done in front of the jury?
Right, referring to the prosecutor's personal notes.
Well, this was brought to the attention of the trial court in advance, and at that point the trial court had ruled that the procedure should be first to show Mrs. Bronstein her own notes, to use those to see if those would refresh her recollection, and if not, then the prosecutor could show the other notes. As far as, the jury was already informed that there had been an interview with the prosecutor, with the social worker, and with Mr. Hill, through Mr. Hill's testimony in laying the foundation. The jury had the opportunity, as part of the credibility analysis or determination that juries make, to, you know, recognize who was speaking here, what was the position of the social worker at the Department of Justice, and also defense counsel had the opportunity to question Mrs. Bronstein and to cross-examine her as to the reliability of her recollection and the notes as well.
So the jury knew that she was refreshing her recollection from a superior in her office's notes, not from her own.
I believe so, yes. But she had already gone through her own notes. And one of the questions that was asked on cross-examination was, why were her notes different from the prosecutor's notes? And she explained that they focus on different aspects of the interview. So.
Well, in essence, if I understand the facts correctly, we've got three people who were at a meeting who were also in court. The prosecutor, the social worker, and the victim, right?
Correct.
And the victim testifies and doesn't say anything about thinking, being fearful that this was his last day on earth, right? The social worker testifies and doesn't say anything about it, and then gets to see the prosecutor's notes and then says, oh yeah, he said, now I remember, he said, I was afraid it was my last day. Isn't it fair to take from that the jury heard basically two people testify about him saying it was my last day on earth, the prosecutor and the refreshed witness?
I don't think I would characterize it that way, because really it's the witness, Ms. Bronstein, saying, Mr. Hill said, I think it's my last day, or I thought it was my last day on earth. The fact that this is no different than a police officer referring to his own report and saying the witness or the victim told me that. You have the prosecutor there, but it's an ongoing interview.
Well, the police officer gets cross-examined
and
about the accuracy of his notes, the circumstances under which he took them, why they're different than the social worker's notes, and ask for an explanation why you, of the three people here, the only one who presumably knows that it's an essential element of the offense, is the sole person here, including the actual victim whose state of mind is an issue, you're the only one that comes up with the answer that neatly fills the gap?
Well, you have the individual, the social worker, who was a witness to this. And so you have an opportunity to attack, I mean, basically they're attacking the credibility of the social worker. And if you're going to have an opportunity to ask, as she did, the defense counsel had an opportunity to ask Mr. Hill afterwards to explain himself on cross-examination, and he basically said, well, yes, I was concerned, but not as much. You have to understand, I'm more concerned for someone else. So the jury...
But the only person who recalled that he said he was in fear for his life that day, sufficient to satisfy the element of the offense, was a person who somehow insulated herself from testimony by prosecuting the case, when she was in fact a fact witness to an essential element in an offense. How did she become the prosecutrix?
Because
under those circumstances,
I think it's been certainly the practice to have another witness during these interviews, and that's why there's a social worker there, so that there's not a question of the prosecutor becoming a fact witness.
But as soon as the prosecutrix finds out she is indeed a fact witness, and not just an incidental one, or one to an essential element of a serious offense accompanied by one for which it's the predicate that requires minimum mandatory jail time, there's no mistrial. And you don't start over with a prosecutor who isn't tainted. You go forward with the case, sort of a rule of necessity, that we've started this case, we might as well finish it. We're going to overlook the fact that a key fact witness can't be cross-examined here. Someone who thrust themselves in the position of being a key fact witness. Someone who chose not to let that go and go ahead and prosecute the case without jeopardizing the entire trial. How can we countenance that?
Well, when you have an interview that goes on before the trial where you have a third party there as that other fact witness who may or may not remember all the details but who was there, whose memory is capable of being refreshed, on the off chance that the witness himself does not recall the details, the prosecutor can't lead that witness, Mr. Hill, and say, did you say this?
They can interview him before trial.
And that's what occurred.
And found out that he didn't have any recollection of it?
Well, I don't know exactly how much time before trial this interview took place. It was sometime shortly before trial.
Would you think that the prosecutor knew or should have known that the only basis for satisfying this element of the menacing offense, the predicate offense for possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony, should have known that before trial, and therefore either stepped out of the trial because she would become a witness, or made the tactical decision not to jeopardize the trial by introducing that into evidence, knowing it was solely dependent upon her notes and her credibility as to whether that was actually said or not?
Well, I don't think it was solely dependent upon her credibility, because I think the credibility of the witness, the social worker, was there.
Well, wouldn't that have even been a simpler way to deal with it? The prosecutor knows that the social worker is going to be called or may be needed as a witness. Prosecutor speaks to the social worker before the trial, says, remember when we had this meeting? Remember this guy said this? No, I don't remember that. Well, look at your notes. Oh, I don't have it in my notes. Well, look in my notes. Do you see it there? Oh, yeah, right, now I remember. If all that had happened before trial, then presumably that social worker would have been able to testify without having to be refreshed by the prosecutor's notes.
Well, Your Honor, that might have been the ideal scenario, but the fact is, during a trial or in anticipation of a trial, I don't know that prosecutors can go over every single detail and anticipate that witnesses are going to forget different parts, and how are they going to prep other witnesses to make sure everything is covered. I mean, you've done your trial preparation. You anticipate your witnesses are going to testify in accordance or along the same lines as to what they've told you or told the police that you have statements thereof. And if something doesn't happen, you know, you have this fallback. It's not perhaps the most ideal way, but it is a way that the trial can go forward with the prosecutor who's invested a great deal of time and effort in preparing this case.
Well, that's the efficiency rule. We've gone this far. We'll run the risk of reversal, even though we know we're putting, contrary to what our ethical standards demand, we're putting our own credibility in issue and then insulating ourselves from having our credibility tested because we're the prosecutor in the case.
Well, I don't think that the jury is as... I think when you have a situation where there is another person involved and it's clearly explained to the jury that person's position, that they're capable of making a credibility determination that does not hinge upon the status of the prosecutor. And I think what they did in this case involving a third person involved in the interview was to insulate the prosecutor from this sort of problem occurring.
Well, let's analyze this for just a little moment. The social worker said, this isn't an area in which I would have taken a particular interest because it's not the questions that I would have asked to explain why she didn't recall the alleged statement about him being in fear, correct?
Along those lines.
Well, I'm sure you can articulate it better than I can, but I think that's the sense of it. On the other hand, the jury's going to hear that the prosecutor, who is the person charged with asking the legal questions and determining whether each of the elements of the crime exist, is the sole firsthand recaller that that statement was made. Now, tell me why we shouldn't be concerned about that placing the prosecutor in the position of being a fact witness against the defendant without any opportunity to cross-examine the prosecutor.
Well,
it is the subject matter area that the jury would think he would focus on. He would have heightened, or she, and I'm talking generally, not this particular case, would have a heightened sensibility toward whether the sufficient facts are present to support an element. Now, whether the jury is sophisticated enough to look at that suspiciously is another issue. But it is a prosecutor putting on that one essential critical fact a stamp of approval because they are a lawyer, they are representing the state, they are theoretically representing the people. Wouldn't you say that's dangerous for a prosecutor and that the better decision might be to leave that information out tactically rather than jeopardize the entire trial?
Well, I think that, first of all, it doesn't jeopardize the entire trial. And secondly, I think that the prosecutor, having focused on clearly beforehand during the direct examination of this witness, Mr. Hill, having tried to draw out from him his memory of his feelings and thoughts on that day. I mean, the jury's already focused on that, and the jury already knows that the prosecutor is trying to get this point out. When you have a situation where the evidence is going along, but you can't get them to say the right words, you can't lead your witness much as you would like to, but you do have the possibility through 3507 to get in out-of-court statements.
Why did the jury have to know that this was the prosecutor's notes as opposed to a person present?
Well, part of the foundation was laid. Did you have this interview? I guess in the best of all possible worlds, they could have just said an interview with other people, but then you run the risk of not being able to lay the foundation because you're not specific enough to get the witness to remember which interview. So you're sort of in a catch-22 situation, I think. It is a concern, and I'm not trying to minimize, the state's not trying to minimize the court's concern. An efficiency rule, I would say that when the risks are, or the probabilities are so small, and the prosecutor in trial preparation has covered the bases as far as interviewing the witnesses, having a third party involved, it is not vouching so much for the accuracy or the reliability of her notes as it is refreshing someone's recollection with a writing that can be tested, as was tested in this case. The defense attorney asked Ms. Bronstein, do you remember the prosecutor asking that question? Yes. The question was asked. This was the answer. And then Mr. Hill on cross-examination tried to explain, you have to understand. Yes, I was concerned for myself, but not as much as for someone else, which is a perfectly reasonable explanation for someone to give.
And this evidence as to his thoughts that this was the last day of his life certainly bolstered his other testimony as to his feelings of concern for himself and for the clerk in the store.
Well, let's be fair, more than bolster, it was the first indication that he was in fear. Concern and fear are not the same thing.
But I think when you have a situation where a gun is being pointed at this elderly gentleman and that he is being told, don't move, don't do anything crazy, and he complies and he moves through the store, wherever the defendant tells him to go and does things, and he stays in the cooler for however many minutes, that all this together is evidence that he was in
fear. Clearly the inference from all you've described could have been argued to the jury without the comment about he thought it was his last day or whatever from concern. But that comment is the one that raised his personal expression under of his feeling at the time from the level of concern to the level of fear for his life.
If I may refer to the state's cross appeal in the few minutes I have left. The state believes that the trial court erred in applying the rules of law to the issue of whether the kidnapping charges should be allowed to go to the jury. In this case, the trial court ignored or overlooked the actual charge as to robbery in the first degree and conflated what the use of force that he was charged with, which was to compel the store clerk to give up the money, with this idea that he was using force to get away and to prevent them from overtaking him and retaining the property. And it really, he didn't apply the law to the facts of this case properly, and he really had a problem with understanding that what he should have been looking at was not how difficult it would have been to get out of this cooler, walk-in cooler, but rather whether or not their confinement in the cooler, the confinement of the store clerk and Mr. Hill in the cooler at gunpoint, was something that was independent of the robbery or merely ordinarily incidental to the robbery. The state has argued that the robbery was complete at the point he said, all right, show me a place where I can lock you in. And that this was a kidnapping, there was sufficient evidence of a substantial interference with these people's liberty that the court should have allowed the kidnapping charges and the related firearm offenses to go to the jury. I have 2.5 minutes left that I'd like to reserve in rebuttal. Thank you. A few comments on the presentation by the prosecutor, and then I'd like to talk about the kidnapping issue and robbery. The refreshing recollection issue with prosecutor's notes was harmful, we believe, to the extent that we believe that there was sufficient reasonable doubt in this case that Mr. Hill had the necessary level of concern or fear for his own personal safety. If this had been a matchbook cover, it might have been different, but these were prosecutor's notes. In fact, we were able to cross-examine Ms. Brownstein and the witness, but the source of those notes we were not able to cross-examine.
Well, that would be the case with anybody's notes that are properly used to refresh recollection.
That's correct, but in this case, these were prosecutor's notes.
Well, so the problem from your perspective is that they were identified as prosecutor's notes as opposed to using notes. Is that accurate?
That's accurate, but I mean the whole issue here is the use of prosecutor's notes at trial in front of a jury. And the state argued that it was necessary for efficiency purposes, to proceed in this manner. We're arguing that it improved their chances of conviction. And they must have felt it was necessary to proceed with that in order to obtain a conviction on the aggravated menacing
charge and its related firearms count.
How many years in prison did your client receive?
Your Honor, on the robbery conviction, he received under the mandatory habitual offender law, life sentence, the rest of his natural life. For aggravated menacing, that count for Mr. Hill, I will point out to the court that the other counts outside of the robbery counts were, of course, sentenced separately. On each of those counts, this defendant was sentenced to the maximum time under 40 K time, mandatory time, no allowance for good time, no allowance for any type of early release. So on the aggravated menacing charge, it being a felony E, he was sentenced to 5 years, the mandatory time under the statute of K time, and with the associated weapons charge, he was sentenced to 25 years in jail, mandatory time, as that statute requires. So there is an additional 30 years of his additional sentence affected by this issue. It also, as I pointed out in the brief, in the facts section under the sentencing section, the trial judge did indicate that he was sentencing to K time on all the remaining charges in the event that the legislature did something different with the habitual offender law in the future. He wanted to make sure that this defendant spent the rest of his life in jail. So it is significant, the amount of time that he was given in his sentence, the fact that it was K time, the fact that they were this is additional time to the habitual offender sentence. Your Honor, on the issue of...
If we accept your argument, why should we reverse more than the aggravated menacing and the associated weapons charge?
Well, Your Honor, this incident, we believe, injected unfairness into the trial, which could have had a spillover effect to the jury. Difficult to measure that, but it did affect the reasonable doubt on that count. We believe
wasn't the evidence pretty strong on the other counts?
Well, Your Honor, I need to sum up now because my time is running out. I did not appeal.
No, you can answer my question.
I did not appeal. There was sufficient evidence to send that to the jury, and the jury found him guilty of the robbery. Your Honor, if I may, the state's cross appeal issue involves the dismissal of the kidnapping statutes by the trial judge after his preliminary analysis required in the Gronenthal case and the Weber case as to whether or not there was sufficient restraint, whether that restraint in the kidnapping that was presented at trial, and it's a very fact-based inquiry, whether the restraint required for a separate kidnapping conviction when the underlying crime is robbery was independent of or incidental to the underlying crime of robbery. We argue that it was incidental to the underlying robbery crime, it being a theft crime, and the statutory definition of theft includes the flight after the theft of the property. In this case, we believe that the trial judge used the proper analysis, did focus on the main issue for disposition of the matter, whether or not the restraint was incidental to or independent of the robbery. The judge in this case made a determination that the restraint involved was incidental to the underlying crime of robbery. When one looks at the facts of this case, as the trial judge has to do in this analysis, the perpetrator did ask the clerk of the store to pick a place where he could put them. She picked a place that was unlockable, that was referred to as a safe place by Mr. Hill, because they knew that she knew they could get out. I have 2 seconds, Your Honor.
Not by my clock.
2 minutes? Excuse me, I will continue then until...
Okay.
My time is up. It's telling me to stop. Your Honor...
Yeah, the 2 seconds was beyond the stop time. It starts running again. As you see, now it's up to 10, 12.
Okay, I'm beyond my stop.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The statutory definition may include theft during flight or after flight, but again, the trial judge did not look at what was being charged in this case and apply the law to the facts. The fact that after the robbery, the defendant said, you know, pick a place, it was just the quick thinking of the victim, the store clerk here. He could have, had it not been a cooler that didn't lock, I mean, they could have been stuck in a freezer overnight. But she knew that it couldn't lock, and then he tried, apparently, based on her testimony, to push boxes and stick them in there. But this is the kind of case that really should get to the jury. The jury, with the proper instruction through Weber, should decide whether or not confining people in a walk-in cooler after a robbery occurs is something that's ordinarily incident to the robbery, or is something more substantial interference in their liberty than was necessary for the robbery. And that's what a jury should do. Although the trial judge acts as a gatekeeper and acted as the gatekeeper here, I mean, the trial judge put the burden on the state rather than looking at this in a light that would allow the jury to consider what was possibly a close case, but really the state argues was a very strong case of kidnapping. At the very least, that this should have gone to the jury with the proper instruction. If there are no further questions.
I have a question. Assuming we agree with the appellant to the prosecutor's notes issue, does that require all convictions to be reversed?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Are you talking about agreeing with both issues as to whether or not there was sufficient evidence without the statement that he thought it was the last day of Earth? I mean, first we have to decide whether even without that there's sufficient evidence. And the state would argue that, yes, there was concern in his voice and under the circumstances. So I'm not even conceding that the ag menacing and the related firearm charges are lost. And as far as the remainder of the other charges, the convictions for the robbery and conspiracy, I don't see how there could be any possible taint. I think in any event, although I don't have the actual cite to it, I mean, normally the charges are given to the jury and they're told to weigh the evidence separately as to each charge. And I think there was overwhelming evidence of robbery and of conspiracy here. You had not only the victims who, albeit were not able to identify this defendant, you had his co-defendant who testified, you had police officers who discovered the defendant in the ivy with the money. His clothes matched the description of the assailant. His body type, his physical characteristics matched the robber. So, no.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. Court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.